Alright, Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen, wa sallallahu wa sallam ala Sayyidina Muhammadin wa ala alihi wa sahbihi wa sallam. Allahumma alimna ma yanfa'una wa anfa'na bima alamtana wa zidna min fadlika ilman wa ta'aliman wa amalan wa fiqhan fi ddeen ya Rabbil Alameen. Alhamdulillah, this is lesson 2 in module 4 in which we are covering the fiqh, or the law concerning tahara, or ritual purity. And we are studying the fiqh of tahara according to the legal methodology, the madhab, of which imam among the great four imams? Imam Abu Hanifa rahimahullah ta'ala. And we spoke before in module 3 a little bit about the history of the development of Islamic law and the madhahib. And just as a brief reminder, the madhab of Imam Abu Hanifa is the collective scholarly effort of hundreds and thousands of great ulama. So it is not just the work of a single imam. And when choosing to talk about fard'ain, matters of law, we do need to pick one for the sake of consistency in organization. But we live in a very diverse community in North America. We're not living in India or Pakistan or Morocco or Senegal or Malaysia, where there's more or less a single uniform school of law that is taught, that is practiced, and that is the basis for the fatwa in that society. Which means that though we rely mostly on the madhab of Imam Abu Hanifa in learning these things, we will, inshallah, mention a few issues here and there from the other schools so that we have a little bit of clarity. Sometimes there are views in the other schools that are easier. Sometimes there are views that are harder. And sometimes people, in learning this, hear things that seem to conflict with what they've learned. And that's okay, because there are differences of opinion, and there are some differences of opinion among the fuqaha about some of the matters we discussed last week. So what we want to do today is just recap and do a brief review on what we covered last week, clarify a few points where there was a little bit of confusion for some people, and then go straight into the next aspect of tahara, which is the wudu itself. What breaks the wudu, and so on. So, going back to the definition, we say definitions are very important because they help organize our thoughts and give us precision in thinking about these things. The definition of tahara, this definition is a legal definition. It is the removal of filth from one's body, garments, and place of prayer, as well as the removal of one's state of ritual impurity, rendering one in a state of ritual purity. And this points to two important things. You have purity, which is the removal of some physical impurity, something we call najasa, or impurity. Urine, feces, the like, those are impurities, physical substances that have to be removed. But then there is the purity which is not removing something physical that's impure, it is removing a state, thereby rendering you in a state of ritual purity. And that is wudu and ghusl and so on. Because you could be perfectly clean and you have no impurities on you or on your garments, yet there are certain things that require you to make wudu. And when you make the wudu, you are removing that hadath, that cause for ritual impurity. So just to clarify here, filth is a legal term here. And by filth it means najasa. It doesn't mean just dirt, because dirt is not a ritually impure substance.
clay, if clay is smeared on your nice, clean, white shirt, we would say that your shirt is dirty. Does that mean your shirt is impure? No. So filth here is a legal term, not a conventional term. Because in societal terms, your shirt smeared with clay is dirty. The shirt you wore working out in the backyard that has grass stains and dirt and oil, it's dirty. It's filthy. But could you pray in that shirt? You could, because there's no legal filth, meaning in a legal category of filth, as in urine, feces, and the like. So this is the definition of tahara. And last week we talked about the types of water. We don't want to go through all of that detail. You could review the notes, inshallah. But just we'll quickly review the types. We mentioned that the first type of water is ma mutlaq, or plain absolute water. And that is water that is pure in itself and purifies other things. So this is basically any water that remains in its natural form. So think about any water that has a natural form and it remains in that natural form. Rainwater, seawater, river water, spring water, well water. These waters remain in their natural form. Unless they are contaminated afterwards, these waters are pure and they're purifying. They are pure for you to drink and use for cleaning yourself and cleaning utensils, for cooking and the like. And they are purifying, allowing you to remove najasa from your clothing or body and to make wudu and ghusl with. So that is the water from various sources, rainwater, well water, and so on. Then you have the water that is pure, but it's not purifying. So you can use it, you could drink it and so on, but you can't use it to remove impurities. And there are some forms of water that are pure and not purifying that you are discouraged from drinking. It's makruh to drink. So they would say that is used water, the water that is used in wudu and ghusl. So in the school of Imam Abu Hanifa, if a person, let's say they're standing in a large bucket, and they're pouring water over themselves, making ghusl. Once that water reaches the body and then separates from the body, landing inside of the bucket, the water inside the bucket is now called ma musta'mal. It is used water. Can you use that water for wudu afterwards? It is disliked to drink or cook with it. It's pure, but you can't use it again, right? And then you have impure water. And this is basically water that is contaminated with impurities. And the scholars of the school distinguish between the small quantity of still water in which some impurity has fallen versus a large body of water, right? So what, does anyone remember, what is the criteria here? What is deemed this small body of water? 10 by 10, or cubits. The ra'a is from the fingertip to the elbow. So a cubit, I don't know how that would measure out in centimeters or meters, but 10 by 10 of that. If it's that size or smaller, and an impurity falls inside, and it's still water, so think of a large puddle. And then let's say there's a dead cat inside, or roadkill is inside of this water. Can you use that water to make wudu? Okay, well, what if you go up to the water, you see the roadkill inside of it, you pull it out carefully, and you examine this small body of water, and you don't smell anything, you don't see any change of color, and well, you don't taste any roadkill taste. Could you use that water for wudu? Yeah. Yes? No. It's too small an amount of water, right? So even if there's no sign, the fact that najasa was in it, you can't use it. But what if you were at a lake and you saw a deer that was dead and floating as a floating carcass on the side of the lake? Could you use, can you make wudu with that water?
Yes.
Why?
Because it's
so much.
Size.
Because the size, right? Now, no one's going to go next to the deer carcass and make wudu, right? But the idea here is that once it's a large body, it's no longer contaminating the water. Now, I mean, these are issues that more than likely we'll never encounter in our own daily life, because as we said last week, the overwhelming majority of our wudu is done with tap water. But these issues come up. The other type of water that we learned about was what they call al-ma' al-maghlub, or the dominated water. And in the school of Imam Abu Hanifa, they make a distinction between water that is dominated by another substance that is solid, jamid, solid substance, or something, a water that is dominated by another liquid. So to give you a scenario, let's say you have a bucket of water, okay? It's pure and purifying. And there's a rainstorm. And you come to this bucket of water and now it's filled with some leaves and twigs, and it's a little muddy, some dirt got inside. These are solid objects, twigs, leaves, and the like. Can you make wudu with that water now?
Yes.
You can, right? Now, at what point would you not be able to make wudu with that kind of water? The fluid nature, right? A saylan. If it becomes so thick that it's no longer with the thinness of actual water, then you can't use it. How likely is that to happen? It's very unlikely. And the examples they give is include using leftover pasta water or fool water or lentil water. This is the kind of water that after you cook the lentils, for instance, there's a change in color, obviously. But if you took that water and put it in the refrigerator and took it out, it would be thick. It would have this kind of viscosity to it. It's changed enough where you can't use that. But it's not as if any of us are looking to make wudu with that kind of water. What about liquid? So you have water, let's say it's pure and purifying, a bucket of water, and you come back and you find that some other liquid has been added to it. Let's say orange food coloring. You come the next day, now it looks orange. Can you make wudu with that water? So it's a liquid added to pure water. The liquid's pure, just like the leaves and the twigs were pure. Can you make wudu with that water? But what do you call that?
Because it's water.
What do you call it then?
Well, it's a big rain or something.
Yeah, I don't know what you would call it if it was orange food coloring, but
sun-kissed.
Well, that would be a soda, wouldn't it? In the school of Imam Abu Hanifa, it's a little bit more relaxed than the other schools here, because if it's still called water, you could use it, as long as you're talking about impurities, obviously. So a better example may be not the orange food coloring, but something a little more relevant. Let's say you prepare a bath and some soap suds get inside and mix with the water. In the school of Imam Abu Hanifa, can you still use that water for purifying yourself? In his school, yes. Because what do you call that?
Water.
You just call it soapy water. It's still water. So they have a rule of thumb they give in the school, which is if it changes its name to some other essence, then you don't consider it water that can be used for purification. Example of a solid, a good one, is tea or coffee. If you add tea leaves or coffee to water, and let's say you have a coffee cup and you have a bottle of water, and you ask someone to go fetch me that water, are they going to ever reach for the coffee? No, even though it consists of water, because it's changed its essence so much that it's not even called water anymore. It's called coffee or tea, right? But soapy water, it's water, right? So again, these things are not really matters we'll really experience in life, but I want to give some case study, two case studies, just to bring this home, inshallah. Important points that we mentioned last week, and I want to reiterate here. The most important thing when learning fiqh is not just the details, but the principles behind them. Because if you understand the principles, you can apply them to issues that come up in your life. You don't have to play a guessing game. So among those principles is that the assumption, the asl, about water is that it is pure. So let's say you're walking in the forest, you see a body of water. What do you assume about that water? Do you assume that it's pure or impure? You assume that it's pure. Does that mean that there's no impurity inside? No, there may be, but you would have to discover that. Your default assumption is that it's pure. Now that assumption isn't lifted, even if there are reasonable possibilities. It has to be certain. Some things in Islam are based on caution, and some things are based on ease. Examples of things that are based on caution, ihtiyat, are matters like meat, and matters like transactions, right? The rights of other human beings, their property, and so on. The basis of those things is caution. Some things are based on ease, such as water. So the rulings on water are based on ease, and that is why the default for water is purity. Now, to bring this home, we want to look at a case study. Someone asks, what about the water inside of a public swimming pool? Now, I don't know if you've heard about this, but there are studies about the amount of urine inside of public swimming pools because of children and maybe adults doing things they shouldn't be doing inside of the swimming pools. If you read these studies, you may not ever want to go to a public swimming pool, but let's assume you don't know them. So you have the public swimming pool. Okay, let's apply the principles. You get to the swimming pool. What is the assumption about the water? Your default, purity. What is the average size of a swimming pool? Is it larger or smaller than 10 by 10 cubits? It's larger. Unless we're talking about one of those kiddie pools, we're talking about a public, large, Olympic-sized swimming pool. So it's larger. So let's say you're at the pool, you know it's pure by default, and it's a large body. And on the other side of the pool, you see some toddler urinating in the pool. Does that render the pool najis, impure now? I heard some yeses. Okay, but it's larger than 10 by 10 cubits. So if it's larger than 10 by 10, does that child urinating in the pool render the entire thing impure? No, it doesn't. It doesn't mean it's not nasty. Like, we understand that. It just means, legally speaking, if you're on the other side of the pool swimming and you see that ghastly sight, you don't have to go rinse off. I mean, you might want to just because of where you are, but you legally don't have to do that. You don't have najasa on you, hukman. Why? Because of the size of the body of water, right? Okay, so that's our first case study. You were going to get to that, inshallah, right? We'll use the mud puddle example and then go back to that. Case study two. Someone had asked about this last week after the class, so I wanted to go over this again. So we see a mud puddle in the middle of a forest on a trail. What is the assumption about that water? It's pure. You look at it, you don't see any animal droppings or anything like that. So you, the assumption is that it's pure. Where did that water come from?
Rain.
And rainwater is under what category of water? Tahir mutahir. It's ma mutlaq. It's absolute plain water, right? You see debris, right? You see leaves, twigs, and rocks. Does the debris render that water impure? No? Okay, does it make that water pure, but not purifying? Meaning, it's still pure, but you can't use it for wudu. Can you use it for wudu? You can. You can. Some people are confused about this, because I think they're confusing between muddy brown water and mud as in the thick mud. So I want to illustrate with a picture. You see the pictures in this slide. On the left you have this brownish colored water, and on the right you see this thick clay-like mud that obviously has moisture in it. Which of these can you use? The one on the left. Can you use the one on the right for wudu? No, you can't. Why? It's maghloob. It's overcome with this solid, right? You can't use that. It's not even called water anymore. It's just called clay or something. But on the left, although it's brown and you might not want to make wudu with that water, it's still pure water. Because when we say pure, remember, pure here is a legal judgment. It's not a conventional judgment. You might say that's dirty, but in terms of Sharia, it's tahir, mutahir. It is pure and purifying. Because although it has a change, this discoloration because of whatever sediment, that has not overcome it to the point of it losing its essence. So if you only have access to that kind of water, which you see in the left picture, you have water you can use for wudu. You are not like a person who cannot find water and must resort to tayammum, which we talk about inshallah next week or maybe the week after, probably next week. So just to close on this issue, because this position about, okay, the chlorine in the water, in the pool. What do you call that water? You call it pool water. It's still water. So in the school of Imam Abu Hanifa, the chlorine added to the water, it is a change, of course. It is something added to it. But it is not so much that it changes the essence of the water. It's still called water, pool water, or chlorine water. However, in some of the other madhahib, there's a stricter position here. In some of the other schools, and you can take this stricter position, in the other schools, they would not accept that. They would say, no, although chlorine itself may be pure, and it's added to this pure water, it results in a change of taste and smell, which means it's pure, but you cannot use it for wudu. That is the stricter view found in some of the other schools. So the Hanafi view is more lenient in this regard. If you wish to take the stricter position, by all means. But this is the school. All right? So that really summarizes what we wanted to say about water. And again, at the end of the day, most of these issues we will never encounter. The most likely issue we'd ever encounter would be wudu if you're out camping somewhere and the water is a little muddy or brown. And now you know how to deal with that. So inshallah, what we have today in the time remaining is wudu. And we want to talk about the hadath, or the ritual impurity, and the two types, right? The minor and the major. Or as we say in our Islamified English, what breaks wudu and what breaks ghusl, right? And then inshallah we talk about how to make the wudu, and then next week the ghusl, and then we go through each thing. So these are our learning objectives for tonight, inshallah. So we said that we're talking about ritual impurity. We're not talking about removing physical impurities just yet. We're talking about the ritual purity, which is the wudu and the ghusl. So the things that require the ritual purity are the minor and major occurrences, what they call al-hadath al-asghar and al-hadath al-akbar. So basically, what breaks the wudu and what breaks the ghusl, right? So those are the two types of things that require either wudu or ghusl. Alhamdulillah, we all know this. So we want to talk about what breaks wudu in according to the school of Imam Abu Hanifa rahimahullah. In his school, they mention these things. مَا يَخْرُجُ مِنَ السَّبِيلَيْنِ, whatever exits from the two openings, the front or back passage of the human being, right? Whether that is breaking wind or urinating or anything of that nature. Filth that flows from other than the two openings, such as blood or pus. And the school of Imam Abu Hanifa, once that leaves the body and begins to flow, it's considered najasa. And let's say you're wrestling with someone, you're sparring with them in the gym, and you get punched in the shoulder really hard. And the next day you see this massive purple bruise on your arm. What is the purple? It's blood beneath the surface. Is that breaking your wudu? No, because it has not exited your body and flowed. But let's say you get cut and the blood begins to flow. Does that break the wudu? Yes, if it flows. So there's a distinction between what's flowing and not flowing. Vomiting a mouthful or more. So this means if you vomit less than a mouthful, as happens sometimes when people eat too much, or if the food is too acidic and they have different gastric conditions, they may have some of the leftover food, they vomit it, but it quickly gets swallowed, that small amount won't break the wudu. But if it's a mouthful or more, then this would break the wudu. Likewise, sleeping in a position such that the buttocks are not firmly planted onto the ground, such as while lying down or leaning on one side. So let's say you're sitting cross-legged, right? And as the khatib, I see this a lot, unfortunately. Person is sitting cross-legged. They're more or less upright. Their posture may be sagging a little bit, but they're sitting. Their rear is parked on the ground, but they begin to doze off like this. And they may even have their head bent for a while. What are they doing? They're sleeping, they're dozing off. But it's a light dozing. Does that break wudu? No, it doesn't. So let's say this person begins to lie down, right? And then they lie down and they fall asleep. Lying down, is this going to break the wudu? Yes. It's not that sleeping itself breaks the wudu. It's that it is madhannatul hadath. It is something that is likely to coincide with the actual breaking of wudu, right? So a person has gas or whatever, that is likely to exit when they are sleeping. Whereas if they're awake, they may be on guard and not holding, either holding that in or whatever. Likewise, if they're leaning on the side or lying down, so that kind of sleep would break the wudu. There's some questions though, you know, we all know those moments when you just want to relax on the couch, you know, and you start to close your eyes and someone asks you, are you sleeping? You're like, no, I'm not sleeping. You hear them and you respond and you have a little conversation. And then at some point, you're in such a deep sleep. At what point is your wudu broken here? Some of the ulama give a little guideline. They say, let's say you have a sibha and you're lying on the couch. You're doing dhikr. Or you're not, you're just holding it. If you were to drop it and it would startle you, your wudu is broken. Because you were that unaware that you were just, you couldn't even control your hand to keep from dropping it, right? So the safest thing is to just assume you broke your wudu if you doze off even briefly like this. Because it's easy to say, I'm not sleeping. And you say that at 12 o'clock and then you say, I'm still not sleeping. And it's 2:30 and you don't know what happened in those 2.5 hours. This happens. Okay. Likewise, loss of consciousness, al-ighma. So fainting and the like breaks wudu. Insanity breaks wudu. Drunkenness breaks wudu. And drunkenness is haram, right? But it still breaks wudu. Laughing out loud by an adult while in salat. The eighth one is unique to the school of Imam Abu Hanifa. It's not found in the other schools. He was of the position that if you as an adult are in salat and you laugh audibly, haha, whatever, your wudu is broken, your salat is invalidated, you have to go make wudu over again. Right? Has this ever happened to any of us? I'm sure it has. And if you wonder how could this ever happen to me, well, wait till you have children. Children do goofy things while you're praying. And if you don't have children, when you have them, you'll see this. The only time I ever almost laughed in prayer was due to children goofing off. Because they know when you begin praying, it's like a green light to goof off and do things because you're in prayer that you can't really stop them. As long as they're not turning on the stove or doing something really dangerous, you're going to pray and just make louder takbirs as a way of telling them to stop it. But laughing would break the wudu in that context.
Is there any, like, where is this coming from? Where, like, the source of this?
I'm not totally clued up on that. There's a narration or two and some, yeah. Because it comes back in the issue of wudu as among the makruhat, right? So there's a point I have here on the slide at the bottom by the asterisk. Does touching impurities break wudu? No. There are a lot of people who are under the false impression that touching something that's impure, najasa, breaks their wudu. I've heard it so many times over the years. They say, well, I have to make wudu because I changed my child's diaper. That doesn't break wudu. Coming in contact with najasa doesn't break your wudu. All you have to make sure is that you have removed the najasa from your hand or whatever came in contact with it, or your clothes and whatnot. But it doesn't break wudu.
The Shafi'i touched the awra, it can't break.
Well, in the Shafi'i school, if you touch the awra, it breaks the wudu. No.
So if a dog licks you, you just have to clean yourself with dirt and then water, you don't have to remake it. Or is that different?
Well, so you're just removing the effect, removing the impurity from your skin. You're not redoing your wudu. Because nothing, wudu is something you do based on what you have done, an act of, that you have done, not something that is done to you like this. Like a dog licking your hand or something. You just wash it. And we're going to come to the whole removing of najasa part later on, inshallah.
Just the
Hanafi,
like the bleeding is like, it's just that to be quite long, that distance. Sort of like
just basic flowing.
Just
Yeah. Now, in the matter of the mouth, like you have bleeding gums, that doesn't break the wudu unless you're talking about where the blood is more than the saliva. The saliva blood ratio is, there's more blood than saliva. But if it's mild, no, ma'afu. Okay, So yeah, we'll talk about the removal of impurities later. We're talking now just about the basics of what breaks the wudu, or you could say what breaks ghusl, or here I put requires ghusl. Ghusl is the ritual purificatory bath. And what requires ghusl is the emission of sperm slash sexual fluid, meni, that leaves its normal place inside the body with pleasure. It's a very precise definition because it uses the term meni, sexual fluid. In this context, it is applied to both men and women, that leaves the normal place inside the body with pleasure. Intercourse, with or without ejaculation. The ending of menstruation or postnatal bleeding. So basically the end of a woman's period or after she's given birth and the nifas is finished. Someone who becomes a Muslim, they're required to make ghusl. In the school of Imam Abu Hanifa, the soundest view is that it's fard and not wajib. So it's something you should really insist on. If you encounter a non-Muslim who wants to be a Muslim, you want to tell them, listen, go take a bath. And for them it's easy, just tell them head to toe, you know, just bathe from head to toe and cover every area with water. That's it. Recommended for ghusl would be for Jumu'ah. In the Hanafi school, it's not required as such, but it's recommended for Jumu'ah, recommended for the two Eid prayers, and entering the state of Ihram is recommended for the day of Arafat, as well as when entering Mecca, Medina, or visiting the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam.
So yeah, for the Hajj.
Yes, yeah, in the context of Hajj. So this is fairly straightforward. And so how to make wudu? It's interesting because I'm coming from this as a someone who studied in the Maliki school, and the way that the fiqh is taught is somewhat different. In the Maliki school, the way it's taught in West Africa, like Mauritania, they'll teach the wudu by example, by actually doing the wudu inside of a teacup. So we're not going to do that though. But sometimes the teachers will do a physical demonstration of the wudu after going through this stuff. It's kind of tough to do it here. We're not going to pour water in the social hall. So let's explain it. In the school of Imam Abu Hanifa, the obligations of wudu, fara'idul wudu, is washing the face from the top of the forehead to the bottom of the chin. So you're looking at the height of the face, the dimensions from the top to the bottom, and then the width would be from one earlobe to the other. So think about where the earlobe is, here. So from here to here, here to here, washing that area. And for men with thick beards, they wash where the skin beneath cannot be seen. It's enough for them, if they have skin that cannot be seen, to just wash the exterior, right? So let's say you have a big, thick, mashallah beard. You're not required as a Muslim man to put your fingers through it and go underneath, because it's thick enough that it covers the skin on that area. But let's say you have a thin beard, what do? You wash it and you put your fingers through it, because you want to make the water have access to that area, because it's not so thick that it's covered, right? The fuqaha, this is the basic description, but the fuqaha mentioned in the other works that you have to be careful here, because the washing of the face, which is mentioned in the Quran as the first part of the wudu, means the entirety of the face. And that includes over the eyelids. So if you have your eyes open, those areas are not exposed to water. You need to rinse, make sure water reaches the skin here and around here and in this area. What do you call these? The I don't know the anatomical term, but the tear duct area, to make sure the water gets through there. Some of the fuqaha say even be mindful to remove anything that may be stuck in there so that water reaches the skin. And these crevices and areas that people may just pass over. The condition is that water reaches it. You don't have to rub every single area, but you want to make sure water reaches it. So that's the first part of the wudu. Then washing the two arms. Here's something every Muslim parent sees, and every Muslim Sunday school teacher sees. Person goes to make wudu, they're washing their arms, they take the water, and they go up to, they go like this. What happened there? What's wrong? They missed the elbows. The verse says, إِلَى الْمَرَافِقِ, right? So here, to the مُرَافِقِ, it actually means slightly beyond. If I say to you, meet me in Monroeville. Are you going to drive from downtown Pittsburgh and stop at the city limit sign, welcome to Monroeville, and just stop right there at the edge? You're not. You could go inside of the actual city. Likewise, when Allah says wash the face and the hands up to the marafiq, it means beyond them. You want to make sure the water reaches past the elbow. If the person is washing the arm, they hear the word arm, they think, oh, this is my arm, and they just wash the arm. They didn't include water past the elbow slightly. They didn't wash the full arm. Because technically, the yed in Arabic, in this verse, is speaking about the limit of the yed is from the fingertip here, up past the shoulder. But Allah Ta'ala puts the limit by saying, إِلَى الْمَرَافِقِ, to this area. So you want to make sure you go above slightly the elbow. This is a very important point. And wiping, number three, رُبْعُ الرَّأْسِ, right? A fourth of the head. What is a fourth of the head? It's basically like this much size. So rubbing, right, with water. And this is وَمْسَحُوا بِرُؤُسِكُمْ, right? Wiping the head, just a fourth. And that's in the school of Imam Abu Hanifa. That is the definition, and they have their hujjah for this. And lastly, washing the 2 feet up to and including the ankles. وَيْرٌ لِلْأَعْقَابِ مِنَ النَّارِ. The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam says, woe unto the ankles from the hellfire. Meaning, you have to be careful when you make wudu that water reaches the ankles slightly above and around and behind the heels and all those crevices. Is again, it's not that you have to rub every single inch in the Hanafi school, but you have to make sure water reaches all of those areas, including the heels and the ankles and all of these regions. If there are spots missing where water has not come in contact with it, that wudu is invalid, which means the salat is invalid, which means the obligation of salat has not been fulfilled. And that the things that are permissible with wudu are not permissible, such as touching the Quran and so on. So you have to be careful there. These are the obligations of wudu. If a person fulfills these, they fulfill the obligation. That doesn't mean there are other things they should be doing. It's just these are the bare minimum as found in the description of wudu within the Quran. So we come from the obligations to the sunan of wudu, those things that are recommended that we should be doing in our wudu. The rule of thumb is do all of these things. We distinguish some from the other so that we know what is the minimum standard, but we do all of these things. We don't neglect them. So among the sunnahs of wudu is to wash the hands to the wrist prior to wudu. Now, there's a context for this. Before the advent of piped in water into homes, where you have tap water in your kitchen and in your bathroom, the water would come from a well or a cistern, and it would be collected, and people would make wudu from a utensil. What do they call it? The lota, right?
Sure.
Right?
Jurun.
What's that?
Jurun,
well,
Jurun,
Arabic. Aniya, right? So, in the madhab, in the school, it's recommended, it's a sunnah for you to wash your hands up to the wrists before you make wudu with that water. And there's a reason for this. Because you don't know where your hands might have been, if they've come in contact with any impurities in the night or so on. So before you use that water, they say, wash the hands up to the wrist. This is something that doesn't need to be done if you're not in that context and it's just tap water, because you're not risking putting in a hand with impurities inside a container of water, which would render the entire container impure. You don't have that error, they don't have that risk. So number two is to begin with tasmiyah. What is tasmiyah? Right, so the school says it means Bismillah, or Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, or even Alhamdulillah Rabbil Alameen. Right, tasmiyah, it means the name, to mention the name of Allah in a general sense. Right? So you can say Bismillah or Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim or other things. Number three, to use the siwak at the beginning. At the beginning. That's the madhab. That's the sunnah as well. And to rinse the mouth three times. Number five, to take the water. So what's number four is called? Madmada. Number five, to take water into the nostrils with three separate handfuls of water. What's that called? Istinshaq, right? The sixth sunnah is to increase the depth of taking the water in the nostrils, provided one is not fasting. And what that means is, mubalagha, shay'an ma, a little bit of taking it beyond just the surface of the nostrils to really, but you know, don't go to excess with this. And if you're fasting, you should avoid this altogether. Just take the water into the front. You don't want to have it go through your sinus and down your throat, right? What's not mentioned in the basic text, but the fuqaha mentioned elsewhere, is that there is an adab here that you should observe. A lot of people don't observe it. Okay, you take the water into your hand, and you sniff it into the nostril. Now what? Where does that water go? Well, you're expelling it, but here's a question of adab. How do you expel it? Imam Malik rahimahullah, he said one should not take the water into their nose and expel it like a donkey. Have you ever been around a donkey drinking water? When they drink the water, their face is buried in the trough, and when they lift their heads up and breathe out, all the water that was in the nostril just comes out like this. You should not do this. This is unbecoming. So what this means is, it's an adab that you take the water into your nose. You don't just blow it out like that. You use the other hand to cover that, so that whatever is removed, it's done with some decorum, right? So that's number six, to take that water. Number seven, to pass the fingers through the bottom of a large beard with the water on the palm of the hand. So let's say you person has a large beard. This would be a sunnah. If they take the fingers, they put water in the palm of their hand, with the fingers they just go like this, right? That's recommended. And eight, to interlace the fingers, takhril al-asabi'. And this is based on a hadith. And takhril al-asabi' is basically, as your hands are wet, you take the wet fingers of one hand and you pass them through the knuckles of the other like this, right? So that you're getting in between the webbing of the fingers. This is sunnah. But there are more sunnahs. To wash the limbs three times, right? This is important because if you wash them three times each, you almost guarantee that there's no spot that you missed. If you do it once, that's enough. However, there's a chance you could have missed a spot and water didn't reach it. But if you do it twice and then three times, you're almost guaranteed to have covered every area. Number 10 is wiping the entire head. So in the madhab, you at least have to wipe rubu'u ra's, a fourth of the head. But it's still a sunnah to go beyond that to the rest of the head. So the first part was describing the minimum, and now it's describing the ideal, so the full head. Likewise, number 11, to wipe the ears, even if with water used for the head. So even if you do this and then go straight to the ears, that's fine. Or you take fresh water, your fingers are wet, and you do the ears. How do you wipe the ears? They give different descriptions, but you can think of it as using the index finger and the thumb, where the index fingers go inside of the ear and go around and down, and the thumb goes behind the ear, and one single motion from the front and then the back, you've done the wiping of the ear. And number 12 is to rub the limbs with water. This is a sunnah of wudu, and this is called dalk. Now, in the Maliki school, to give you a stricter view, right? Dalk is required, it's a wajib. If you don't do dalk, your wudu isn't even valid. The Maliki school is the strictest in this regard. This means that it's not enough for the school of Imam Malik for you to simply pass your arm over the water faucet. Let's say you have the running water, you just pass your arm over it and move it around and the water reaches everywhere and beyond your elbow. In the Hanafi school, that's enough because all that matters is water reaching it. In the Maliki school, that is not enough. You have to make sure that your hand or some object is rubbing the water around that area, right? And for things like ghusl, they say even you can use an object, or you can even hire someone to bring a back scratching utensil, wet it. It's detailed, but that's a stricter view. Now, in the school of Abu Hanifa, to wipe the limbs is still sunnah. It's just not a fard that if undone, your wudu is invalid. Your wudu is still valid if you don't do it. Number 13, to wash the limbs successively, right? Without pausing between them. What does this mean? So it says, such that in normal weather, the last part would not dry before one began the next. So let's say you're making wudu. You wash your right arm, you go up beyond the elbow, you're doing everything, and then your child calls out to you, mommy, daddy, so-and-so is burning the scrambled eggs downstairs. And what do? Do you finish the wudu? Or do you go downstairs? Well, you should go downstairs, probably. You go downstairs, you realize it's not that big of a deal. Just turn off the stove and scrape the eggs out, and problem solved. Can you go back upstairs and begin with the next arm? Or do you have to start all over again? Huh? What's that? You can continue. Same thing in the school of Imam Abu Hanifa as well as Imam Malik. However, it's with a certain condition, that the limb has not dried in the normal amount of time it would take to dry in normal weather. So if you are in Death Valley, California, it dries instantaneously. That's not the time we're looking at. If you are in the jungles of Borneo and it's really humid, it'll stay wet for a long time. We're not looking at that either. We're looking at the median climate, what is seen as basically normal. So if we boil that down to a time limit, it could be 3 to 5 minutes. You know, it really depends. But you have that kind of, about that much of a window between washing one limb and washing the next. If that time elapses, and in normal weather that it would have dried, you start over again. This is useful especially when you have children and things happen and you got to intervene. So it's good to know.
If you dry it yourself, like, you, like at work, you want to wash one foot, you know, then you dry it up, then you just have to work.
Yeah, so the point of consideration, the i'tibar, is the time, and the drying aspect is just the babit, the guideline for understanding when is it seen as too long, not the extraneous act of drying on your own. Yeah, the idea is that not so much time has elapsed, that it's just a small break and you go right back to it. I mean, and this is an important question, because let's say you wash your arm and then you drop your watch on the floor. You bend down to pick it up and you, okay, 30 seconds has elapsed. Is that too much time? Like, who gets to say that's okay, but not 3 minutes? Right? There has to be some guideline. There has to be a standard. And so they say the amount of time it takes for a normal limb to dry in normal weather. Number 14, intention. This is particular to the madhhab of Ibn Abu Hanifa. The intention is a sunnah and not seen as a wajib, or rather a fard. And there's a highly technical usuli reasoning for that. We'll not go into that now. But you should always have an intention. And it's actually hard not to have an intention when you do these things. But that's what they list here. Number 15, it's a sunnah that you have mu'alat, or chronological order. So let's say you washed your left arm first, and then your right arm, and then your left foot, and then your right foot. Is that wudu still valid? Yes. But should you do that? No, that's against the sunnah. The sunnah is to do it from the right and then to the left. Or we could say, that's actually lesser an issue. Let's say you washed your feet before your arms, right? You've gone against the proper order, but it's still valid, even though that is contrary to the sunnah. So these are things that none of us are probably ever going to do, but it's good to know that this is what is sunnah and this is what is fard, right? So do everything in the proper order. And to begin with the right when washing the limbs, this is a sunnah. Some say it's recommended, mandub, which is a little bit of a lower level. And to wipe the neck. This is in the Hanafi school. To wipe the neck is seen as either sunnah or mandub. And that would be basically just wiping the neck like this, right? Now, doing all of these things all together with the fara'id and sunnah put together, you have a sound wudu that enables you to pray, to make tawaf, to touch the mushaf, and so on. And beyond those things, you have certain adab, which are, they're recommended because they are part of decorum and etiquette, but they're not necessarily an explicit part of the sunnah or things that one must always do, but these are good things when possible. And they say to sit on an elevated place is from the adab of wudu, the proper manners of wudu. And the reason why is, go back to the water. What happens when the water has reached your limb and falls off of the limb? What do we call that water now? Call it used water. Can you use used water for wudu? No. So if water has dripped from your limbs into something, can you go back to that water and then use it for washing another limb? No. How likely is that to happen? It's unlikely. But if you're sitting in an area where the water is dripping and getting all over you, there's a chance that water is, the used water is mixing with the other water. This can be a little problematic. So to avoid that, it's better to have an elevated place, or to pour the water or use the water in such a way that it's not going to spill out and get on you, whereby you're using it inadvertently as you continue wudu. So we don't have to really think about this too much, because where are you usually making your wudu? Your bathroom sink. that's already elevated place. The water is elevated, it's away from you somewhat. So you've covered that. Number two, to face the Qibla. If that's possible, if you're outside, for instance, you could face the Qibla. That is a good thing, the direction of the Kaaba. Number three, to abstain from talking. And this, they mean general speech that is not dhikr. You're not going to talk about who's going to win the playoffs and all of that with your wudu partner before jama'ah in the wudu area. I mean, you can, it's not haram, but it's against the better manners of wudu, unless you're making dhikr. Number four, it is from the adab of wudu to make supplications before and after wudu. And we have prophetic du'as before wudu, tasmiyah in general, and there's some other du'as. And then du'as that we make after. And these are things that one can memorize. It's from the adab of wudu as well to gargle and draw water in the nose with the right hand and expel the water with the left hand. Remember what we were saying earlier? That when you take the water to the nose, you're not just blowing it out wildly. You're taking the left hand and using that to assist in expelling that water. And lastly, performing wudu before the prayer time enters. That's a higher adab. That if dhuhr is at, what time is it coming? Let's say it's 1:20. You are aware that dhuhr is coming in. And so you go and make wudu at 1 o'clock instead of making it after dhuhr has already come in. That's a higher adab according to the madhab of Imam Abu Hanifa. As far as what is disliked, it is disliked to waste water. And there are a number of hadith which speak about this. The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam said not to waste water, even if you are sitting next to a river or an ocean. So even if you have a pot of water or a bucket of water and you're next to a river, that doesn't mean you should waste it, right? People take the tap and they run it full blast while they're taking off their watch and letting it warm up, and they take off their kufi, take off their socks and get the towel ready, and the water's just running on full blast. It's one thing to heat the water. You sometimes need to run it for a little while, but we're talking about running it full blast, just wasting it. This is makruh. You could have it at a lower setting so it's not releasing so much. It's also disliked to slap the water on the face. I know you've seen this. Everyone's seen this. It's as if the person thinks, well, if wudu is a blessed act that draws me near to Allah Ta'ala, then maybe I get more ajr if I smack myself with the water, if I really vigorously apply it to my face. That is makruh. Because you respect the water and you just take it and you wipe your face. That's it. And lastly, it is makruh to speak words of general speech devoid of dhikr, right? This is disliked. We're running out of time, so maybe we'll take a couple of minutes here. This is the last slide, by the way. Not all wudu is the same. There are different types of wudu or purposes for wudu. You have the wudu that is obligatory, and that's the wudu you have to make before salat. Or the wudu you need to have before you make sujood at-tilawa, when a verse of Quran is recited that upon which you make sajda, you need to have wudu before you make that sajda. So if you hear that verse recited by a reciter or someone in your house and you don't have wudu, you don't make that sajda. You need to have wudu. Likewise, it is obligatory to have wudu to touch the mushaf, even a single verse on a piece of paper. Now, this is the position of the four schools, by the way, that you cannot touch the Quran without wudu. لَا يَمَسُّهُ إِلَّا الْمُطَهَّرُونَ. That none touch it except those who are purified. This is the position of the four schools. It means you have to have wudu before you touch the mushaf. There are some details here. If it is a book of fiqh, if it's a book that has some Quran but not all Quran, then you don't have to have wudu. But we're talking about the Mus'haf, the Qur'an, the full Qur'anic text. But in the school of Imam Abu Hanifa, this even applies to a single verse on a piece of paper. So what about the Mus'haf apps on our digital devices? Can you touch those? I am of the view of those ulama who say you can. However, there are some who say that you must have wudu to touch those too. Because regardless of the nature of the digital text and the interface, as they argue, you are still putting your finger on the screen that is in contact with that. So what you'll find, to be on the safe side, you can use those apps and touch the Mus'haf app without wudu, but it's good if you find the apps that are designed like this, where you have the space above it or below it where there's no text, and you can slide your finger there without putting your finger directly on any of the verses. And by doing that, you have avoided the khilaf, right? And you're in a safe space. And you can read the Quran without wudu in that state. That's fine. You can touch the translation because that's not Quran. Yeah, that would be the same thing as touching the other space where the verses are not there. But I personally am of the view from the ulama that I trust in this matter and whose research I have confidence in, that even if one was to put their finger over the actual verses, they're not touching it because that is beneath the screen. And that is something completely different from ink that is written and fixed to a paper text. So I'm not convinced personally, but it's good to have these options.
Wara.
And to avoid the difference of opinion so you're on the safe side. Yeah.
Wara.
Wara. Conscientiousness, being cautious. As far as the other types of wudu, we'll just quickly go through them. The number one is obligatory. Here it means fard. The mandatory means wajib, and that goes back to the fard-wajib distinction in the Hanafi school. One, which the fard is qat'i al-thubut, qat'i al-dilala, the other is dhanni al-thubut, or a mixture thereof. So it is mandatory or wajib to make wudu for tawaf around the Kaaba. It's recommended to make wudu before going to sleep, or after waking up, when touching books of Islamic law, just fiqh and so on. It's also recommended to make wudu ala wudu. So let's say you have wudu and at 10 in the morning, you pray duha, zuhr comes in. You already have wudu. It's still recommended for you to make a fresh wudu over that wudu. There's a reward in that. Likewise, it is recommended to make wudu after backbiting or slander or any sin in general, because wudu washes away the effects of sins. Not to say that wudu is enough for washing away certain sins, you still have to make tawbah, but it is recommended. Likewise, it is recommended after laughing loudly outside of prayer, right? As well as after washing a dead person, doing the ghusl for the deceased, or carrying the corpse of the deceased. It's recommended to make wudu for every prayer, when angry, and when reciting the Quran from memory, or reading hadith, or studying Islam. And you could say when making dhikr as well. Basically, anytime you are doing something involving the study of Islam, the reading of Islamic text, invoking Allah, dhikr, and so on, it's good to have wudu. And to preserve wudu is a highly meritorious action. It's not always easy, but as we remember from the previous class, وَلَا يُحَافِظُ عَلَى الْوُضُوءِ إِلَّا الْمُؤْمِنِ, that no one but the believer preserves their wudu. So this is a very basic outline of really the bare minimum knowledge concerning what breaks wudu, what breaks ghusl, and how you make wudu. And what are the bare minimum standards of wudu, what are the sunnahs, what's recommended, what is disliked, and what are the adab. Now, not all of these are individually obligatory to know. You don't have to know that it's good to face the Qibla, but since we're learning this in one place, we might as well mention those things. So inshallah, next week we'll talk about the ghusl, and then work our way through the other sections of tahara until we finish it with the bathroom etiquette, and then go to the salat inshallah. Walhamdulillahi rabbil alameen. Eating camel meat. Eating camel meat does not break wudu according to any of the madhahib except the madhab of Imam Ahmad ibn Hanbal. So if you wanted to make wudu after eating camel meat, following the view of Imam Ahmad, khurujan min al-khilaf, to avoid the difference of opinion, then this is good. This is good. You don't have to, but it's good. Pardon?
How loud you have to be while laughing?
How loud? Audible. You hear yourself. When they say jahar, out loud, the minimum standard is that you can hear yourself. Doesn't mean that someone down the hall has to hear you. It doesn't mean this loud, guffaw, boisterous laughing. But if you can hear it, it's a laugh. I mean, at least in the Hanafi school, what's mentioned as wajib is for tawaf, not for the sa'i.
Sa'i can be done.
As far as I know, yeah. Any other questions?
You talked about tasmiyah, like when we go into the bath, like for instance, it's time to make wudu.
Good question.
I have to use the toilet also.
Right.
So I say my dua for entering the bathroom. When I'm done and I have to make wudu, I mean, can I say tasmiyah right there?
I think we had a discussion on this in the sisters class, didn't we? So we call a place, we call it a bathroom or a restroom. In classical Arabic, the area for relieving yourself is called the khala. And that's a specific area, and one is not using the khala as the same place where they're making wudu. In our time, we have a bathroom which has a shower, has a bathtub, has sinks, has drawers, it has the toilet over here. So do we say that all of that is the same space, and all in the rulings of the khala apply to the whole space? I'm not so sure, because there's a certain demarcation between the shower and the shower curtain and the area there versus stepping out of it. So as far as I am concerned, if there's a demarcation, even if you're in the same room, so to speak, because there's a demarcation between one area and the next, if you say Bismillah over here, it's not the same thing as saying that while you're on the toilet. So I don't have a problem with that. But if the person's in a very dirty space and it's just a toilet and some tap, say it outside before walking in, or say it outside and then walk in and then do the wudu to be on the safe side, inshallah.
So just a glove for entering the bathroom will not be enough.
I mean, the tasmiyah is a sunnah, and if you want to avoid the questionable nature of doing it inside of the bathroom near a toilet, just step outside, say it, and then just walk right back in. I've heard some people suggest that.
Can we do this because we expect to have a lot of questions?
Yeah.
Sometime next week before the class.
Yeah, we'll take some other questions next week, inshallah. Just save it. Alhamdulillah.